From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. You all know Wendy Murphy is a former district attorney, law professor, sex crimes expert, and author of the book And Justice for Some, an expose of the lawyers and judges who let dangerous criminals go free. And I thought I'd bring on Wendy tonight to talk about several different subjects, and we're going to start with the juice, and I don't mean apple or orange. Hi, Wendy.
Good to be with you, Dana.
That's kind of...
No, you know, I don't think I've enjoyed a glass of orange juice in 13 years, if you know what I mean.
How creepy was that? 13 years to the day, and...
Well, you know, yeah, creepy, poetic. I mean, there are so many words I'm thinking about.
Poetic is perfect. That's for sure. Now, I've interviewed many DAs, former, current defense lawyers, people covering the case. A lot of them, in fact, I'd say more than half, didn't think that he'd get convicted. And wham, he gets slammed for everything. Your thoughts?
Well, I don't understand that attitude because my opinion in the early aftermath of the arrest was that he would ultimately plead guilty because the case against him was so strong.
Right.
You know, wishful thinking, and I was clearly wrong, but there's no question I wasn't surprised by the verdict. Now, that's because I'm kind of a sucker. I tend to make assessments based on the facts.
Right.
And so,
who knew?
For example, during the Michael Jackson case, I was convinced he'd be found guilty too, because why? I had an objective view of the mountain of evidence against him. What I think people sometimes do when thinking about a case against somebody like O.J. Simpson is they say, well, notwithstanding the facts, he's going to walk because this is the kind of case where jurors can't think straight. I understand that, but I think the reasons he got a walk 13 years ago just have no application now. So you really can be objective about the evidence. And I think the best way to measure whether the jury is likely to be objective and fair is to ask what's going on at the courthouse. Are there mobs of crowds outside the gates? You know, is it a huge media story? Because the more the sort of the mob at the gates problem outside the courthouse, the greater the chance the jury is going to do something stupid. You know, I have a whole chapter in my book called Acquittal by Frenzy, and that's the thing I worry about. Mm-hmm. As someone who cares a lot about the law and our legal system, I really, you know, I just get very irritated about the notion that you can win by creating a mob scene. O.J. did that once, but because there was no mob scene this time around, I felt pretty confident that the evidence would speak for itself. And if you view the evidence objectively, you know, you'd have to be a slug crawling around with earthworms not to find this guy guilty this time.
You know, it's interesting because you look at the cast of characters, and believe me, it's a cast of characters. I'm thinking of that old movie where the old retired guys go out and they want to do one last score, rob a bank before they all die. And this was a bunch of geriatric old guys that were going to rough and tough their way into getting O.J.'s stuff back. And then the gun came along and all that. And I agree with you, Wendy. You know, 13 years ago was a totally different situation. But now Simpson's lawyers are running around saying that, well, he was convicted as a revenge or whatever you want to use that term. Because of that. And of course, the appeals are going to start. But I don't think I'm one of the few like you that agree that that was a good case right from the get-go. I don't think they're going to have a leg to stand on.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think the judge, ironically enough, despite how everybody felt, you know, throw the book at him, the judge went way out of her way to make sure that he got every bit of due process and then some, just because, you know, you don't want him to have some reason to say, oh, this was vindictive. You know, there is something about the voyeuristic nature of our interest in the case that feels a little bit put on, but just because we all want to watch the guy fry doesn't mean the courtroom indulged our desires.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he got a super fair trial, probably a fairer trial than you or I would have gotten. So I'm not worried about that. You know, it is. It does have a kind of the gang that couldn't shoot straight facet to it too. And I was on Fox News yesterday, and I said, you know, I totally disagree with all the brouhaha about how he's going to get life in prison or mandatory 15 years. I don't think he's going to get that much time. I'd be surprised if he got more than 5 years. And I say that because, as much as it is a serious charge, kidnapping and armed robbery, and there was a gun, as you pointed out, Dana, there's kind of a goofy gloss to the story. And I'm not trying to make light of it because, you know, any crime is important, any crime is serious, but there's a spectrum of severity. When you talk about armed robbery, you know, on the far end is when you go into a bank with a gun and you steal money, any amount of money. There's a different feel to that kind of crime than this goofball crime that he committed with a bunch of goony, really sort of dopey guys. It doesn't mean that if you're a dope and you commit a stupid crime, you get a discount. It's just that the judge is the one who has to decide the sentence, and the judge is going to have in her head this range of types of kidnapping and types of armed robbery, and I don't think this is going to be way up there for her. You know, it was a kidnapping, but in a very loose sense. Going into somebody's hotel room and not letting them leave is a very different kind of kidnapping than grabbing somebody off the street and throwing them in a van and taking them away. It's still kidnapping, technically, but I think all of those things are reasons why he's likely to get far less than what people are saying. And keep in mind, I want to make it clear that he's not likely to get a very long sentence because I don't want to build too much sympathy for this guy. His lawyer ran out. Yael Galaner was out the minute the jury came back saying things like, oh, this was racism. Oh, this poor guy's going to spend his life behind bars. And my favorite one of all at the end of a couple of the news stories was that comment he made, oh, my children, I'm not going to be able to see my children graduate from college, and I've worked so hard to help them get through college. I actually think his daughter didn't even finish and doesn't have any time for him anyway, you know, moved far away from him as fast as she could, so that's a bunch of nonsense as far as I know. And she went to college up here in Boston. You know, I could be wrong. I hope she's back in college, but my sense is that that wasn't even a true statement. Moreover, who cares that he won't see his kids graduate? Their mother isn't going to see her children graduate either, and he didn't mention that. You know, so I don't have sympathy for him. But I'll tell you this, Dana, and this is the one thing I hate to say this because I really want to wring the guy's neck, and my personal feelings toward him are you know, probably like everybody else's. You just want to get his arrogance right out from under him and, you know, wrap it around him and just kind of slap him around. And he's so arrogant, and he's so sociopathic in the way that he parades around in the aftermath of getting away with a double murder. He should have just shut up, and he didn't. He was in our face for 13 years. Ugh. So I had that same emotion. On the other hand, I don't think, you know, you don't prosecute a guy because you're mad because he's arrogant. You know, I don't think that's a fair way to treat anybody. As much as you want to wring the guy's neck, you don't want to be vindictive about it, because that's not what our legal system is about. So along those lines, and I also said this on Fox yesterday, and, you know, I've had on-air fights with O.J. Simpson at MSNBC. Mm-hmm. He heard me call him some name or another, and he called in, and he's just crazy. He'll fight with people on air, and he has no love for me, and vice versa. But what I said yesterday, and I, you know, I'm very curious to hear what others think about this, was, why did the jury stay so late? You know, I've been a prosecutor. I know when juries want to come back. When juries are close and they're about to come back with a verdict, a judge will let them stay past, say, 4 o'clock. Maybe they stay until 5, 6, 7, even 8. I've had juries stay till 8 o'clock at night. 11 o'clock, you know, that's really late. That's so strange to me. So maybe they do. Maybe that's just normal for Vegas. I know everything starts a little late in Vegas, but it struck me when I heard that it was the 13th anniversary that maybe somebody should ask these jurors, did you know it was the 13th anniversary? Is that why you wanted to stay so late? Is that why you came in under the midnight line? You know, because if that's what they did, if they intentionally found him guilty on the 13th anniversary because they wanted to make this a poetic moment in history, you know, that's not right either. That's just not right. They should do their job, be objective, and you know, not indulge the limelight and the silliness. And so if I were the defense, I would be thinking about that, and I'd be asking questions, and you can bet Yael Galaner is trying very hard to locate the jurors and ask them those questions. He's going to file a new trial motion next week, And if the jurors have anything to say of interest on their awareness about this anniversary date, you know he's going to put that in his motion for new trial, and he's going to say these jurors were biased, not based on race, not based on race, based on this vindictive sense that they wanted to send a message or be poetic or, you know, make up somehow for the unjust acquittal. So I don't want to hear him talk about how it was a racist jury. You know, the notion that you have a constitutional right to a jury of your peers doesn't mean if you're black, you're entitled to a jury of black people, and if you're white, you're entitled to a jury of white people. That's not what a jury of your peers means. It means people who will not judge you with an unfair bias. Well, you know, if they wanted to find him guilty on the anniversary, I'd say that's something for the defense to use to argue that this was a kind of bias. I don't know if it'll rise to the level of unfair. I don't think it's going to reverse his convictions on appeal, but you can bet Yul Galaner will make something up it if he can.
And I was going to ask you the next question is, the media will be all over these jurors like birds on a bug, and are they going to have to be careful what they say because the defense will grab a hold of that and make the argument you and I just talked about?
Well, you know, my feeling is that jurors should be honest. I mean, if they...
Yeah.
Look, if a bunch of jurors in a rape trial got together and said, let's find the guy not guilty because we think that girl is just a piece of trash, and, you know, let's find him not guilty because we think she shouldn't have been out drinking or wearing a short skirt, I would want to know that the jurors were so stupid and the jurors were talking like that and that they had that degree of prejudice, because, you know, the law requires that they not make an assessment based on silly ideas about how women dress or what they're drinking and so forth. So my sense is that jurors shouldn't talk too much about how they debated one another, how their processes worked, whether they persuaded one another in this direction or another about how they felt about the credibility of a witness. But if one of the jurors in that room said, I want to find him guilty on this day because it's the anniversary, yeah, I think they should tell. And Dana, I'm being fair, because I say in my book that one of the best things that happened under California law after the unjust acquittal 13 years ago was the so-called squeal rule. I think that's what they call it. But the point is that because people were so angry that they believed the largely black jury got together and said, let's just find him not guilty, you know, to make up for Rodney King or to, you know, do a good deed for the brother, or whatever they said to each other. If you find somebody not guilty because they're black, and you're black and you think there's something about blackness that means you should ignore the evidence, if you say that in the jury room, somebody should tell. Somebody should rat you out and squeal on you, and you should tell the judge, and the judge should kick your butt out of the jury room.
Yep.
That's not an American jury system that I know and love. But it goes both ways. If the jury got together and said, let's find O.J. guilty because this is the anniversary of the unjust acquittal, that's not right either.
Wendy Murphy's here. We're talking about O.J. In a little while, we're going to get to Casey and Keeley. Anthony, another high-profile case in the news. O.J., like you say, has been in our faces for 13 years. He's been looking for Nicole's killer. I've interviewed Denise Brown several times on this program, and I'm sure the family is just wanting to get on with life rather than sit back with a smile on their face, because O.J. is O.J., and we'll just leave it at that. But when you look from the victim's rights advocate portion of this, Wendy, is this justice for the Goldmans and the Browns?
Oh, you know, I don't know. I think that's a very personal question to ask of them. I suppose if I were them, would I be a bit gleeful that at least he's going to prison, even if not for my crime? I would probably feel good about that. My brain doesn't work that way, and in the sense that I don't want to have a legal system that goes out of its way, and I don't think it went out of its way in this case, so don't get me wrong, but I don't think we should celebrate a conviction for one crime as a kind of idea that it makes up for something in the past. It's just hard for me to think that way, because I do an awful lot of academic work, and most of what I try to do is get things to be a bit more fair. So, you know, from a victim's rights perspective, would the individual victim feel good in some personal sense of justice that he at least is serving some time in some case, somewhere, somehow? Probably. Do I, as an academic type, think that that makes our legal system any better? You know, not so much. Where I feel good about, you know, as a as an observer, where I feel good about the fact that he's behind bars is that he has been so arrogant, so ridiculously sociopathic in the aftermath of the acquittal 13 years ago, so in our face about how celebratory almost that he felt about that victory, that it was the height of arrogance when he walked into that hotel room with a gun and a bunch of buddies and thought he was entitled to do what he did. You know, if there's one thing I feel good about, it's that anybody who's so arrogant, that the way he paraded around for 13 years, if he's so arrogant that he's marching into hotel rooms with guns and stealing stuff, you know, that I feel good about. As, just as a human being, as a citizen, watching my legal system deal responsibly with someone who really doesn't deserve to live free in society, that's why I feel good. He is not the type of human being who should be walking around free in society. Anyone who has such disregard for human life, such arrogance, you know, this is the right result for a man like that. He should be behind bars, not to make up for the unjust acquittal, but just because he's not a human being who should be walking around free in society.
Yep, and I guess in this case the glove did fit. Let's let's change subjects here a little bit and get on to the tragic, sad case of little Kaylee Anthony and talking about sociopaths. The mom, Casey Anthony, here we are all this time later. A whole bunch of property crime charges laid against her, financial charges, fraud, bad checks, etc. But we have a little girl that's still missing. We have some forensic evidence, but the Orange County Sheriff's Department comes out and says that now she is a suspect. Well, duh. where are we going with this case? Is this ever going to be resolved?
You know, I think the fact that they named her a suspect is just the next notch on the belt in the pressure they're exerting against her.
Yep.
You know, nobody that I know sees what's been going on as anything but an attempt to squeeze her, because they know that she knows and she's got to tell. And I think the reason she's got to tell is not because they don't know what happened. I think authorities do know what happened. What they don't know is where the body is and who else might have been involved. So I get the feeling that what they're really hoping they get from her is a disclosure about who else was involved and details about where she abandoned the body. Now there's another problem here, which is that if she doesn't tell one of those things, then I don't know that they'll ever prosecute her, because it, you know, it's a little bit like the Ramsey case. They know what happened.
Exactly.
They know it was either the mother or the father, but they couldn't quite figure out which one to go after, because if they prosecute John, he blames Patsy. If they prosecute Patsy, she blames John. You can't guarantee that either one could, you know, wouldn't stand up for the other, so it's a wash. You can't win that case. I think it's a little bit like that, and they know what happened, but because they can't say that it was her and her alone that killed the child, there's a real concern that if you prosecute Casey, she could point the finger at any number of people and probably at least raise reasonable doubt and walk. So they need her to give them that little bit of extra information. Now, my personal sense of all this is that there's a lot more to the story that the investigators and the prosecutors know. My my hunch is that there's something more sexual involved, that there are pictures that we need to hear more about, and this is pure speculation, so just bear with me.
Yep.
But we heard talk of the computer having photographs of the child, and that Casey deleted some of the photographs. All that does to me, I mean, red flags all over the place. What kind of person deletes photographs on their computer? Well, you know, even if you hate your kid, you don't have to delete them not to look at them, right? So it's not like she deleted them so she wouldn't see the girl's face, because the girl's pictures are otherwise all over the house. I think she deleted them because they reveal something more sinister, perhaps something sexual, perhaps something pornographic. You don't just delete pictures of your kid. Why would she delete them? In my mind, it goes to the question of something pornographic. Then, you know, there was a very interesting news story that few people picked up on, but not a lot, about, and I'm going back a month or so now, actually probably more than a month, maybe a couple months, but there was a news story about how right before she was rearrested, I think, the first time, a sex crimes detective showed up at the house. One of the local reporters there wrote about it and said, what's the sex crimes guy doing here? What does this case have to do with sex crimes? And the response was a very generic, well, you know, he's just reestablishing an old relationship, an old friendship with the family, or something like that. Well, I didn't believe that, because sex crimes guys just don't show up out of the blue to reestablish old friendships. Now, it's possible, but it sounded funky to me. So I asked somebody who was close to the family. I said, who was the sex crimes guy? You know, the official statement was that he was there to reestablish an old relationship. Do either of the grandparents, either of Kaylee's grandparents, know this guy? And if so, how do they know him? And, you know, what was he doing there? And the answer I got back was, they have no old relationships. They have no contacts. They don't know what you're talking about. In other words, that was obviously cover. Mm-hmm. Somebody said he's there to reestablish an old relationship, I think, as cover, so that the public wouldn't start saying, oh, it's a sex crimes case. Oh, it's a sex crimes case. But I think there is something about the sex crimes guy showing up that we're going to hear more about. I think we're going to hear more about photographs. I'm very concerned that we haven't heard about whether there were any drug tests done on the hairs that were found. Because, look, if that child had chloroform, which, by the way, is a drug used sometimes to sedate children who are used in child pornography, I'm not saying that happened here, but we know chloroform was present. If chloroform was used to sedate this child, we know that the hairs were present in the trunk. Did they test the hairs for the presence of any kind of sedative drugs? What does that tell us about the possibility that there was some kind of pornography going on? Was this an accidental death, an accidental overdose from one of those sedative kind of drugs? And is that why there had to be a lag time in the disposal of the body? There were too many people involved. I mean, look, this is just a theory, and who knows? But chloroform, you know, the put that together with the pictures, there's so much more to this story, and I think squeezing her is important. So probably the fact that she's been named a suspect is step one in what's going to be an increasingly serious series of very hard moments of squeezing, one of which I hope will be a public disclosure of what kinds of photographs she deleted from her computer. Because you know, Dana, yep, and all your listeners know, you can never really press delete and have anything delete. There's always a way to find that which has been deleted. So you know that people know what was going on, what was on the computer, what they found, where it went. I just think the public needs to hear more about that, because, you know, that's part of how we help solve these crimes. When more truth comes out, people get more focused. They look in, you know, they don't waste their time looking in silly spaces. And I think the public is really eager to help. You know, you've been covering it. Nancy Grace has been covering it. Everybody wants to know what happened, because we all look at that little girl's face and think, geez, that looks like my kid. That should be my kid next door.
Yep, absolutely. And one last question before I let you go, Wendy. Florida has a strange disclosure law, so we've seen and heard videos and audios and thousand pages of typed evidence. A lot of this really doesn't mean much, at least in my opinion. I think they're keeping the real evidence close to the vest, but you have forensics in the car, you have forensics on the computer, you have chloroform in the car, you have searches for chloroform on the computer, you have all of this stuff tied together. What I'm hearing from my listeners and seeing, you know, on other shows is, why are they waiting so long? What is this magic thing that they're waiting for? You know, you could think the body, but they're not having much luck with that.
No, and the body may well be under a huge trash dump, and or in, you know, eaten by alligators. I mean, there's so many ways that the body can be disposed and never found, especially when you have 30 days. So I don't think they are expecting to find the body. I do think they're hoping they can squeeze Casey. And, you know, she's lasted an awful long time. It's highly unlikely she will roll at any point in time, period. I just don't think she'll ever give up. All that said, we don't know what they have. So they could have enough to really put the pressure on And maybe something will happen. I think the fact that she keeps getting rearrested and released and rearrested is proof positive that all they really want to do is drive her crazy. They just want to drive her crazy so that she'll have a telltale heart kind of moment. I don't see that happening because she's lasted so long, but that doesn't mean people might not come out of the woodwork. Obviously, there's a lot of money out there. I don't know what they were awarded. It was $250,000 last time.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
That's a lot of money. And, you know, even if this is some kind of child porn thing, there are people who, for that amount of money, might talk. I think if they've tested the hair for chloroform and they know that there were drugs in the child's system because it did show up in the hair and they have the photographs, one of the things they might ultimately do is charge her with something other than murder.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they can't show that she killed Kaylee, but they might be able to pin on her enough of a participation in the aftermath, enough of a participation in the creation of the pictures, if that's what's going on, that they'll arrest her and actually prosecute her for something. Remember what happened with, what's his name in Chicago, you know, organized crime boss,
right.
Al Capone.
Yep.
They couldn't get him for all the murders he did, so they got him for tax evasion. We may end up seeing a story sort of like that when it comes to Casey Anthony, because I think without a body or more information about who else might have been involved, it's an unwinnable case to prosecute her for murder. But that doesn't mean they can't get her for something.
Get her for something else. And too bad Elliot Ness wasn't still around, and he can maybe work on this. Wendy, thank you as always.
They're squeezing her pretty well, I got to say. I'm giving them credit for that.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you, Wendy.
My pleasure. Bye, Dana.
Bye-bye. That's Wendy Murphy, former DA, law professor, sex crimes expert, and author of, and I love this title, Injustice for Some, an expose of the lawyers and judges who let dangerous criminals go free. We're going to continue on with OJ, and we'll have Michael Bryant from the Legal Edge Network. He's one of the last reporters to get an interview with OJ Simpson. Of course, the Legal Edge Network is the new internet site that does gavel-to-gavel coverage on trials, and they covered the Simpson trial, and we'll have Michael Bryant here soon on the Dana Pretzer Show right next. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. Once again, here's your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, we're back. We're going to continue on with our discussion regarding the juice, and in particular, how the lights went out on him. And I don't mean that as a joke. Literally, just while he's being sentenced, the lights went out in the courtroom. It's kind of creepy. 13 years later, the lights go out, and now OJ has had that knocked-out punch. And someone that was there covering the trial, and you know, his internet site, the Legal Edge Network, did a great job, I thought. In fact, my next guest, Michael Bryant, was one of the last reporters to get an interview with OJ. Hi, Michael.
Hey, Dana. How are you?
I'm great. You know, last time I had you on the show, we were talking about the Legal Edge Network getting started, getting going. It was going to be Nevada versus Simpson. That's done. You guys did a great job. Congratulations on that. You even got an interview with OJ. Were you there when the lights went out on him? And I mean that literally.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it just added to the whole kind of creepy, surreal nature of what was going on. Because, you know, you're sitting there, and who couldn't be thinking back to 13 years to the day earlier and what had happened? And it was weird. And, you know, everybody thought, you know, somebody was just fooling around with the lights. The judge looked over thinking somebody had fallen against them. And obviously it was just the timer because, you know, 11 o'clock Friday night in downtown Vegas, you're not normally in a courtroom.
Exactly. You know, not sure if you've been listening, but the guest previous to you, Wendy Murphy, was a little surprised that the jury stayed out so late. But then again, she said, kind of like you, this is Vegas. Maybe this is what was going on. Why did the jury not call it a night? They just kept going. I guess maybe you can't answer that.
Well, I can tell you the things that we heard while we were sitting there, because we were all at the courthouse for 14 hours that day. And, you know, you hear some things, you can't confirm some things, but we heard that there was a real desire to get this done on this anniversary.
Right.
Now, whether there's any credence to that or not, I don't know. I mean, I'm a strong believer in Friday verdicts. And when the jury said they worked through lunch, and when the jury asked for dinner and worked through dinner, the general consensus was, well, these guys are close enough. They think they can get it done today. Now, maybe they were optimistic. Maybe they found that as they finally started crunching the different counts that they were, you know, not as certain on some as they thought they might be. And so it just took a little longer to get where they were going. But I still think they knew they could get it done, and, you know, as they continue to plod through it, they just said, you know, let's just get it done. You know, we got soccer tomorrow, we got whatever, you know, we got lives to lead here. It's been 4 weeks already.
Yale Galanter, I'm sure, will be watching the jurors in the next little while. The media will be all over them like birds on bugs. And he'll be wanting to hear, in my opinion, one of them say just what you and I have been talking about and say, that's not fair to my client. Your thoughts?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, one of the things you can't do on the appellate level is invade the thought process of the jurors, you know. So if you had... you'd have to find some pretty strong evidence of some inappropriate juror conduct to use that as a basis for an appeal. He, of course, is going to be looking at the racial bias issue for his purposes.
Right.
He'll be interested, for sure. And he may find some, you know, comfort in the things that they say if it supports what he believes happened. But, you know, what I think is interesting, what I think people maybe are forgetting is, no matter what happened or didn't happen 13 years ago, there was a lot of evidence to convict these guys in this case. So if there was some undercurrent, some undertone of the jurors that we'll get him for what he got away with last time, I'm not sure it matters, because there was plenty of evidence in this case to convict.
The co-accused that was tried at the same time, why is his name slipping my mind here right now? I'm sure you'll know it. There's a lot of sympathy out there for him, although they don't look at the big picture of what kind of guy he was. He's convicted because he's sitting at the table with O.J., blah, 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 all this sort of stuff. Your thoughts on that angle?
Yeah, you know, C.J. Stewart, really, you know, if this is anything, it's a lesson in how to choose your friends.
Exactly.
He really got sucked into it. He had, you know, quite a bit to do with it, and I think his attorneys believe that he has such a good shot at getting this thing overturned because of the lack of any severance requested pretty much every few hours during the case, that they didn't want him to take a plea, you know, because he was, you know, he didn't bring the guns, but he certainly was more involved than Charles Cashmore, who basically was the white guy hiding in the bathroom, or Charles Ehrlich, who very briefly posed, you know, as the buyer and, you know, then just became one of the guys hauling things out of that room.
Right.
You know, this is the guy, C.J. Stewart's the guy that physically touched, you know, Bruce Fromong and Alfred Beardsley and to frisk them and had some active role in telling people what to do with the stuff. And you know, so I'm not saying he wouldn't have gotten a plea deal. Obviously, Walter Alexander did, and obviously the wannabe gangster Michael McClinton did. But I think his attorneys believe that we can win this thing on a severance motion, and they've certainly laid the groundwork, and I would not be surprised to see his conviction overturned as a result of you know, the stink that might have attached by sitting next to O.J.
Michael Bryant's here. He's from the Legal Edge Network, and his network covered Nevada versus Simpson. And, in fact, Michael had a short interview, and you can see it on their website, with O.J., talking about him singing in the hallway and faith and all that. Your thoughts on the last interview with O.J.? Was it, actually?
Yeah, it was. It was the only interview during the trial. So at this moment, until he, you know, comes up with some plan to do what I'm sure will be an extensive sit-down with somebody, you know, I'll certainly be throwing my hat in the ring for that. I'd be shocked if that happened. But, you know, we just developed just a bizarre relationship during the course of the trial where we would talk virtually every day in the hallway about golf, about football, about kids, I mean, about religion. And, you know, one day I was asking him what he was doing for the weekend, and I was expecting some golf story, and he said he was, you know, going to church with his buddy Randall Cunningham, who the super NFL quarterback from not all that many years ago, started with Philadelphia and then had a big strong finish with the Miami Minnesota Vikings. And I said, well, that's, you know, it's a great story, you know, and he's taken his money and his passion and he's turned it into this church just outside of town. So I had followed up with that a little later in the week, and I said, you know, thanks for the idea. That's a great story. I'm going to do it. And he offered, well, I don't think I'll be there for the early service, but I might be there for the second service. They had 8:15 and 10:15. So I didn't pursue it. I just said, okay. We go out there about 9 o'clock to shoot B-roll of Randall. We had set up with his people the interview to be done after the service. And I get there, and we're looking around, and sure enough, there's O.J. and Carmelita, his sister, sitting in the back of the church for the early service. And when they break, I meet him in the lobby, and he kind of smiles and laughs and says, well, you know, I thought we would, you know, kind of beat you here by coming to the early service. And I said, no, I just want to say hi and thanks for the tip on the story. I think it's a great story. And I said, but I'm here. I got a camera here. I got to ask. You mind if I ask you a few, faith-based questions? And it was as simple as that. He said, yeah, we went outside and we did it. And you could tell from the interview, even though I'm asking pretty innocuous questions on purpose, because I didn't want to feel like I sandbagged him. It's not the way I work.
Sure.
He talked about stuff that he sure didn't have to. He talked about how the trial at times can be kind of wearing on him. He offered, such an interesting take on his raising the children in Catholic versus Baptist church, because Nicole wanted the kids raised, and we're talking about the younger kids, mm-hmm. Sydney and Justin. She wanted them raised Catholic, and he wanted Baptist, so in Miami, where they now live, they alternate going to different churches. So it was curious that at this time in his life, with this much going on, and with everybody knowing the background of the past and Nicole, he still brings her in to his current existence. And I don't know if that's guilty conscience. I don't know what it is. Mm-hmm. But it was an interesting experience to talk with a guy, and I hope to talk to him again.
Well, exactly. I'd sooner see you talk to him than Barbara Walters asking him if he was a tree, what kind of tree he would be.
Yeah, well, I probably won't do that if it happens, yeah.
Yeah, and what was it here? Larry King was talking to that Ahmadinejad from Iran and asking him if he had kids. You want to have the hard-hitting questions, not ask him, what kind of weather it is today. Michael Bryant's here from the Legal Age Network. If you want gavel-to-gavel coverage, that's the place to go. What's next for you guys? This was a great start.
Yeah, it really was, and we were, we almost did this as a beta test. People who watched on the site noticed there were really no ads on there, and mm-hmm. not a lot of the clutter you see on other sites. And we'll probably change that. There will be some clutter on there because we wanted to find out, what kind of audience we had and how long they stayed on the site. I mean, as much as I love doing this, it's got to be commercially successful. It was technically successful. I think it was a critical success. We got to make it commercially successful to keep doing it. So what we do next is always very important, and we get, tons of interest in Spectre, and I will tell you right now, for the first time, to anybody really, that we probably will not be doing Spectre, and the reason is very simple. I floated out there the idea of doing Spectre on a sponsorship basis, because we can't, as a business, get tied into a trial that is so long,
right.
And that, to be honest, didn't rate very well when I was with Court TV, and it was aired on Court TV. It was 6 months, and the ratings were horrible.
Mm-hmm.
The rerun, I don't think, is going to do much better. So although I acknowledge and understand there's this intense core of people who want to see that trial, from a business standpoint, it would be very risky for us to do that. So what I explored was, well, if we could do it as an additional trial and we could cover our expenses, if somebody wanted to pay $20 a month, whatever, mm-hmm. let's explore that. We couldn't get enough people with even the interest in doing that. So we're looking now at Baby Grace, which is the case out of Houston, actually out of Galveston, although I think it will be tried in Houston because the recent hurricane kind of wiped down Galveston. And that starts in about 3 weeks, and we're concerned at this point about whether the judge will let us do gavel-gavel, and so it's still kind of an iffy proposition. If all the judge will allow is openings, closings, verdict, that just doesn't cut it for us. So, anybody out there hears of a trial in the next 3 weeks that, of some interest, that has some level of high profile, and certainly we'll look at it, but we're kind of looking at Baby Grace right now.
Yeah, it's a good one. There's so many cases out there right now, high profile type, that haven't gone to trial yet. The Anthony one in Orlando, for example, what will happen with that? But let's expand a little bit on the Legal Edge Network and get you to tell the folks just what it's all about and what it will be about.
Yeah, what it is right now is about half of what it will be. The live gavel-to-gavel coverage is obviously a core asset that we wanted to promote. But it's also consumer news features, which is really how I began the brand, The Legal Edge, about 12 years ago. And they're kind of quirky and funky, and they're 90 seconds of really legal stuff you can use in your life. How to get your deposit back from your landlord, how to have a roommate pay for half your bills and not get screwed on that deal.
Mm-hmm.
So those things we will begin to populate the site with as we transition from this first trial to the next. Caught on tape stuff's going to be on there because it's, to be honest, it's very popular, and it's kind of a tangent of legal information that's kind of interesting, whether it's a convenience store holdup or a dash cam or whatever. We're going to have hundreds of those items on there as well. So what it is all things legal. We also will have a legal news page, which will be mostly links to other sites and their specific articles, but we'll also have our own original stuff on there as well. And message boards, which we thought we could get up for this first round, but we had some problems with our development team, to be honest with you, and we kind of switched horses in the middle of the stream, and it really threatened us, but we got through it, and we made it, but now we can go back and add the features we didn't quite get around to.
Once you get all the I's dotted, T's crossed, and everything up and running, I see this as an example of what the Internet can do that mainstream media can't do or has gone away from, and the potential is huge. What do you think about that?
Well, that's been our idea all along. I mean, having worked at Court TV and having seen the beginning of what I think is unfortunately the end there, and they've not announced it in any way, but I was so lucky to meet up with all the friends and folks I worked with before. We spent some time out in Vegas together, and they did a great job out there. They had their own little Court TV city, or True TV city.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the writing's on the wall, and, you know, I'm not bashing them. It's unfortunate Turner has decided to do this, but the fact is I think it's going to be gone. And the more I get into what we're doing, the more I believe the web is the place for trial coverage, for the very simple commercial reason that you never have to leave. Your ads can coexist with your live content. You know, so what we found, and this has been amazing to me, our average viewer on the web stays there more than 2 hours at a time. And it basically is cyclical with, you know, recesses and lunch.
Yep.
The average time on any given website in this country right now is 6 minutes. You know, and we got people on there 250 minutes.
Right.
That's good. You know, commercial advertisers like that. So, you know, if you've got two trials, three trials going, whatever you have, you don't need to turn away from the trial to sell cookies. You know, you can sell those and people don't miss. We didn't have one moment that we did not have on that site from a technical standpoint. And Matt Portum was the guy who was responsible for keeping that thing going. He was my on-site chief producer there, and he provided a lot of the bulletins people got, which was a great feature. We really enjoyed that, a breaking news feature that if you weren't actually on the site and you got a little tickler that said, hey, the verdict's coming, boom, you could go on the site. And so you're right. The Internet is the place for this kind of product because you just don't have to get in the way with the commercials.
Well, the public has a total craving for it. Of course, when you see O.J. Simpson or any case, this Anthony case, you know, all sorts of them. I'll use my show as an example. We have non-stop content. We can pick story after story after story. It's sad, but it's true. It's a fact of life. But, you know, one last question for you, Michael, and I really appreciate you coming on. You've done the TV part. You're doing the Internet part now. You're not going to be able to be the guy to get from place to place to place, although I bet you'll try your best. What are you looking for that?
Yeah, what I think will happen, you know, as I envision this thing growing, I would always like to have some role in it, just A, because I enjoy it.
Sure, yeah.
And I think if we have, let's say, an A, B, and C trial, then I will, you know, I'm not that special. You know, there are other people out there that can do this. And I would, you know, I would look to expand our staff to have people, you know, covering the other trials as I am doing now. So they'd be there to report on and update whatever's going on a day-to-day basis. So it's very doable.
Absolutely. Michael Bryant from Legal Edge Network, thank you, sir.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye. And I thought they did a great job covering O.J. And in fact, I used the term, and I wasn't, you know, being stupid or funny. The lights went out on O.J. I was watching it on the Legal Edge Network, and all of a sudden, I thought they lost their feed. I thought Legal Edge lost their feed and something went down, and all of a sudden, blank, she goes black. But it's still streaming, and I can hear the voice, probably of the bailiffs, very loud and crisply saying, everybody stay in your seats. And then the judge saying, what happened? And somebody turned the switch out. And literally, the switch got turned out on O.J. What's going to happen? Wendy Murphy thinks he won't get much time. I think he's going to get hammered. I think he's going to be going away for the rest of his life. We shall see. My name's Dana Pretzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. Once again, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, we're back. One thing that I've noticed with the presidential election going on right now and the mess that the economy is in and the attacks on the candidates with Saturday Night Live and all this sort of stuff, that some of the war on terror stuff, and that's not a very good term to use, stuff, but it's true, has been put on the back burner. In fact, we're not hearing about it. There's a news article that I read the other day on WNBC.com about how airline and aviation-related companies are suing the CIA and FBI to force terrorism investigators to tell whether or not the aviation industry was to blame for the September 11th attacks, of course, in 2001. Two lawsuits in the U.S. District Court in Manhattan sought court orders for depositions as the aviation entities build their defenses against lawsuits seeking billions of dollars from those families and those that were victims, of course, in 9/11. There's a great new book out right now, and my next guest, author Bob Schottmeyer, has written it, called Prior Knowledge of 9/11, and I thought I'd bring him on tonight to talk about that, talk about the book, obviously, the aspect about why we're not hearing this right now. We're hearing a little bit, but certainly not enough, and just who knew what prior to 9/11. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Dana. How are we doing?
I'm great. Am I wrong, or is it we're not hearing, we're hearing more about Saturday Night Live and Tina Fey and Sarah Palin than we're hearing about lawsuits, aviation industry, what the CIA and FBI knew? I consider that a hell of a lot more important than Saturday Night Live.
Well, people love entertainment, but and the information on the 9/11 attacks kind of wanes and diminishes. It comes and goes, so I'm not discouraged over the fact that it's kind of minimized now because of all this crisis in the economic situation.
Yeah, that's true. Your book, The Prior Knowledge of 9/11, or 9/11, whatever you want to call it, it talks about the details of the CIA's culpability in this disaster. Tell us about why you wrote it and what it's all about.
Well, I'll give you the heads up right off the bat, and it's horrific. I had found out about the attacks on February 11th. I don't want to go into that tonight, but I found out every detail, including the fact they were going to hijack four planes. They were going to go after the World Trade Center. The attack would take place in the first 2 weeks of September. I essentially knew how many people they would use in the attacks, 4 to 5 Middle Eastern people with 4-inch knives. I had estimated when they had entered the United States to start their training, when they started their training, when they finished their training, when they brought in the non-pilot hijackers, and had all that estimated, and then was not able to do anything about it. So when the attacks took place, I called up the FBI, went down there, told the FBI on September 11th that I had known about the attack, that my entire company had known about the attack back in February, and asked them if they thought I was to blame.
And the FBI's response?
They said, Bob, you could have come in here in February. Don't feel like it was your fault. The information that you had, that they were going to use for 767, 757 type airplanes against the World Trade Center in the first 2 weeks of September, hijacked out of Eastern airports, wasn't specific enough. We would have had to know the flight numbers and the actual terrorist names.
Now, when you start talking about specificity and these sorts of things, my audience and I will both raise our eyebrows and say they needed to know specific names and flight numbers. That sounds nuts.
Well, it does sound nuts, but it turns out there was a systematic scientific process that you could go from material that the terrorists had written right down to virtually every detail in the attacks. And I had been flying from Narita Airport in Japan over to San Francisco, out to New York, and had bought some reading material in the Narita Airport in Japan, and it was on the Al-Qaeda terrorists, and it had the documents in there that had been written by the terrorists. One of the documents is called the Declaration of Jihad Against Jews and Christians, and it has inside of it a thing called a fatwa.
Mm-hmm.
And the fatwa goes like this. It's the duty of every Muslim in the world to kill Americans, both civil and military, in wherever country they are found, and destroy their possessions. And I'm sitting there on the airplane trying to figure out, well, who in the hell would write something like that?
Yes.
And came to the conclusion that was a declaration of war against the United States. It had been written 10 years after they started the Al-Qaeda movement, had to mean they were going to hit us with a massive attack inside the United States. And then realized in about 45 minutes that if they were going to go after a mammoth attack, and this was written in February 1998, and I'm on the airplane in February 2001, if they had waited 3 years, they weren't going to throw a grenade at a McDonald's in Cincinnati. It had to be against some of the biggest cities in the United States, against some of the biggest buildings. Realized after 45 minutes that they were bound and determined to go after the World Trade Center. And if you read the book, you'll see exactly how I came to that conclusion. Realized they'd hit the World Trade Center in 1993, and essentially the same people,
mm-hmm.
and they used truck bombs, and they couldn't use truck bombs again, so they had two choices at that point. They could either sit across the street and shoot spitballs at the World Trade Center, or they could use hijacked airplanes. I was on a 757, so I realized they were going to use airplanes. From the photographs that I had of the World Trade Center, which was actually in the travel brochure in my seat pocket, I came to the conclusion they were going to use two planes per building against those big towers. And then it was a matter of figuring out how long it was going to take to train the pilots. And I estimated it would take them a year to train the pilots, 3 months to bring them in and get them started, 3 months on the back end, and a month to put them together. And then finally put that timeline on February 1998. Now, that didn't work because the buildings would have been down by February 99 or September 99, a year and a half before I even got on my airplane.
Right.
So I moved the date out as far as I could go, and I had to pick a magic number. So I picked February 2000 when they started bringing in the pilots. So if they brought them in February 2000, then February, March, April, they were trying to figure out what their flight schools were located. In May, they started their flight training. Next April, they were done. May, June, and July, they brought in the non-pilots. August, they put them together. September 1st, they're ready to go. That's September 1st of 2001. They're ready to go. And when you look at the cold bombing, man, they don't wait. They just bang, it's over. And I realized by the middle of September, those buildings were going to be smashed to smithereens. Came back to my company and told every single person that I looked at this. And I'd actually gone through my analysis over and over and over trying to prove it wasn't going to happen. And told everybody in my company those buildings were going to be smashed to smithereens before the middle of September. And I had come to the conclusion there was absolutely no way they would not carry out this attack. And I asked everybody if I should go to the FBI, and every single person in my company said, Bob, you go to the FBI with that, they are going to lock you up and throw away the goddamn key.
Right.
I was down at those buildings on the 14th of February trying to prove to myself that once they get clobbered by these giant airplanes, they wouldn't come down.
Mm-hmm.
Got down there at midnight on the 14th of February and looked at them, and I've never been so horrified in my whole life. They were so tall, with respect to their dimensions from side to side, that I realized they would, once they got clobbered by these planes, that what would happen is the fuel from those huge planes would come in underneath those long floor trusses. That at night you could see a 10-foot light spot and a 2-foot dark spot. And I realized that with 150,000 pounds of fuel on those giant airplanes, if they came in under those trusses had to be made of lightweight steel, they would buckle. They would pull the connection between the truss and the outside columns down, or pull them apart, and the outside column would have no support frontward, forward, or backward, and the floors would just pancake down on top of each other, and the columns would just fly out, and the buildings would actually break where the planes hit them. And I got down on my knees and I just wept, and I kept thinking, I'm going to go to the FBI and tell them this. They're really going to throw me in the nut house.
Well, I'll tell you, it happened. It happened in 93. It's, whether you're a cab driver in Manhattan or a milkman in Sheboygan, you could have probably guessed that if they were going to attack again, the symbol of the World Trade Center was where they were going to go. They didn't do it right. They're going to research it. They're going to get after it a second time. Bob, I'm going to ask you one last question before we go. Our time is gone. And remind the folks to go to www.events.com/911.com, or there's a link in our show notes to learn more about the book and how to buy the book.
And I'll just give you one heads up here.
Sure.
When I did my research, I was trying to find out why the CIA and FBI hadn't done the same research I had done, and found out in the end that the CIA had deliberately, not accidentally, not unknowingly, had deliberately allowed the attacks to take place. They criminally withheld information from Kuala Lumpur from the FBI, and I found at least four or five humongously wide-ranging criminal conspiracies to hide that information from the FBI. And then in the end, when they found Midhar and Hazmi were in the United States, I don't know if you're aware of it, but the CIA knew that Midhar and Hazmi in July were going to take part in these huge attacks. Were you aware of that?
I've heard of it.
Well, there's an email out there that's in this thing called The Substitution of the Testimony of John. It's on my website.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, and Wilshire, who is one of the conspirators, says that Midhar will take part in the next big Al-Qaeda attack. And when they found out Midhar and Hazmi were in the United States, two people that were involved was Tom Wilshire and Dina Corsi. They conspired to keep the investigation away from FBI agent Steve Bongart, and they shut down his investigation. And the information that I have on my website is ironclad proof they did this in a criminal, nefarious scheme. When Corsi told Bongart on the 28th of August that he could not be part of the investigation of Midhar because the information had to come from the NSA, she had already gotten the release that morning from the NSA that said the information could be given to Bongart. And when Bungard said, this can't be true, that there must be something wrong, I have to be part of this investigation, this guy is in here to carry out some gigantic terrorist attack, he asked Corsi to go to the legal people at the FBI headquarters to get a ruling. And the next day, Corsi comes back with a ruling. Well, I found out that the attorney that gave her the ruling is an attorney called Sherry Sable.
Right.
When Corsi said that the attorney had ruled that Bungard couldn't be part of the investigation, the attorney told the FBI IG investigators that she ruled just the opposite. She ruled that Bungard could be part of the investigation because this information had nothing to do with FISA. And if Corsi was confused, she could have gone to the NSA and gotten a release herself, completely unaware she'd gotten the release on the 27th of August. Can you imagine that?
Well, and our time is almost up, Bob, but this story is
one... The source documents are on my website. I've got the exact documents. I've actually got that release from the NSA, and it shows it came into Corsi at 8:05 in the morning on the 28th. The day she tells Bungard he's not allowed to be part of the investigation because the NSA won't allow it. And I've also got the testimony from Sherry Sable right on my website.
Yep, I'm looking at it right now.
And I've also got the account of Safon. Safon is the FBI agent that was in charge of the Cole bombing. And every time he asked the CIA for information on, if the CIA had any information on any meeting in Kuala Lumpur or had any information on Khalid Benitesh, which was known to be the mastermind of the Cole bombing, he was told there was no information. But the CIA already had all that information. And there was a huge conspiracy at the CIA to keep this away from Bungard. In fact, the meeting on June 11th, which is now the famous meeting between the CIA and FBI, had been set up by the CIA as a sting on the FBI, not to give the FBI any information, but to find out what the FBI knew about the meeting in Kuala Lumpur. The CIA was horrified when Safon sent us a request in April of 2001 that the FBI investigators on the Cole bombing had found out about the meeting in Kuala Lumpur and found out about Mihdhar and Hazmi. So they set that meeting up specifically, and Corsi is the one that set up that meeting along with Wilshire and Shannon to find out if the FBI had found out about the meeting in Kuala Lumpur. And so when you read my book, you'll just be goddamn horrified.
Yeah, absolutely.
Imagine this. All this is now in documents, government documents.
Yeah. You know, and the book is Prior Knowledge of 9/11. The website is eventsonnineeleven.com.
www.eventsonnineeleven.com.
Yep.
And if they want to get the book, now the first printing's almost out because I've had a huge rush on the book. But when you read the book, everybody who's read the book has been thunderstruck.
Absolutely. It's quite a story, and I appreciate you coming on, Bob. Thank you.
Yeah, and if you'd like me to come back again, let me know, and we can do it again and go through the book in more detail in terms of the FBI and CIA.
We'll talk to you. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. That's Bob Schottmeyer, and who can say that we on Scared Monkeys Radio don't cover every story that we possibly can, and we'll let you decide if there was prior knowledge of 9/11 by going to www.eventsonnineeleven.com. We've got about 3 minutes left in the program. If you want to sneak in a quick phone call, area code 306-842-7884, 306-842-7884. I want to thank my guests tonight, Wendy Murphy, Michael Bryant, and Bob Schottmeyer. And again, you know, here at Scared Monkeys Radio, we cover all the stories. We let the guests come on and say what they have to say, and we'll let you decide whether or not you want to believe what they say. Is something that we haven't heard about before, but it's certainly interesting when you go and look at this website and get their opinions as far as what's going on. I remind you that our webpage is www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. There you can listen to podcasts of past programs, listen to the show live. You can listen to my daily commentary. You can listen to anything you want to listen to and leave comments, whatever. And, of course, the creme de la creme of blogs is scaredmonkeys.com. That's www.scaredmonkeys.com. Again, I thank you all for tuning in this evening, and we'll see you again real soon here on The Dana Pretzer Show. Good night.
You've been listening to The Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.